You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Welcome to episode 342 of the podcast, and in this one I got back on Dr. Stephen Phillipson. Stephen is a licensed clinical psychologist, and this one in particular, we talk about sleep, including desperation around sleeping, what is sleep and the stages of sleep, how sleep medication, alcohol, and benzodiazepines can affect sleep quality, using sleep as avoidance, insomnia, sleep as an independent system, how trying to sleep may be causing a lack of it, what Steve doesn't like about the CBT sleep hygiene approach, Steve's approach to helping his clients sleep, why sleep shouldn't be the goal, getting an OCD spike at night, OCD in our dreams, and much more. This episode is supported by Cambridge University Press and Dr. Lynn Drummond's new book, Everything You Need to Know About OCD. Now, Lynn was on the last episode of the podcast. Definitely check that out if you want to find out more about her and her new book. Lynn's book describes and evaluates pros and cons of various treatments, including psychological and pharmacological treatments, empowering people to advocate for themselves in a medical setting. It features self-help chapters about graded exposure therapy. It has clinical examples and case histories throughout to help demonstrate points in real terms. To get 20% off Lynn's new book, go to cambridge.org/everythingOCD, or the link will be in the show notes and description of this episode. And when you're on the website, simply use discount code OCDstories20, that's OCDstories20 at the checkout to get 20% off. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. Thank you as always to Steve for his wisdom around OCD, and I found this one particularly interesting. I hope you guys do too, and thank you to all of you as always for listening. I deeply appreciate it. Without further ado, here is Steve.
Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Thank you, Stu. It's good seeing you again as always.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. And of course, we're going to talk about sleep and anxiety, or I guess sleep and OCD. So I guess initially, is there anything you want to say on the topic to get the ball rolling?
So in my mind, for the past 20 years, I have an article written about many topics. And the article that I have written about sleep is titled Sleep, the Hostage of Anxiety. And the reason being is that people engage in a tremendous amount of ransom paying to try to get to sleep. Many, many people see sleep as sort of an elixir, like a necessity for the foundation of quality living, or even functional living. The sleep industry is really a multi-billion dollar industry, if you think about it. People are advertising different beds to facilitate sleep, different types of pillows, different types of sheets, different types of pajamas. And then there are the medications that are being sold to facilitate sleep. So sleep is something that many, many people experience tremendous desperation to achieve, to control, to manipulate and influence. I had a period for about maybe 5 years where I really struggled with sleep. No surprise, my wake-up alarm generally would go off at 4:30 in the morning. And I would generally go to sleep, or just let's say go to bed at 11 p.m. So with the idea that I'm going to get maybe 5.5 hours of potential sleep, my brain was very desperate to achieve that magical state of mental recharging. And we'll get into that a little bit more. So, you know, what is sleep? And really, there are many phases of sleep, but we're only going to talk about two today. One being the state where we're no longer kind of conscious, where we are in a state where we're no longer directing the show. And many people think that sleep is a goal, that is not actually correct, because sleep is the stage or potential gateway to what's called REM. REM stands for rapid eye movement. And why is there so much attention to REM? Because REM is where our brains are literally recharged, just like a battery. And so people try to get to sleep, but what they often don't realize is that using certain medications to achieve sleep will often block the gateway into REM. I always think I would rather have 4 hours of natural sleep than 8 hours of medication-induced sleep, because even in that 8 hours, there's a chance that REM will not take place nearly sufficiently. So, sleep is, for many people with OCD, a bit of a safe haven. Many people with OCD try to sleep for 12 hours or more, because in sleep, their minds don't necessarily torment them about their OCD themes, or people don't experience anxiety. And so some people even use sleep as a bit of a ritual, as in the avoidance aspect of managing anxiety. So I just want to say that on things that can block REM, we'll start with alcohol. That if you drink at a certain point before going to sleep, sleep can be easily attained, but REM becomes blocked. Alcohol is a huge kind of physiological deterrent for people to go into REM. And so I've had many patients talk about after drinking large amounts of alcohol that the next day to actually 3 days, they feel completely off. Their OCD is on a rampage and they're in a psychological and physiological kind of a mess. And they have a tremendous payback from using alcohol before going to sleep, or even using alcohol to achieve sleep. The same can also be said for what are called benzodiazepine. In this country, medications like Xanax, Klonopin, Valium. These medications also can induce sleep. They're called narcotics. But once again, there is sort of this payback, and there's a great saying that goes, every form of refuse has its price. It's from an amazing song by the Eagles in the 80s. And so the use of these medications to achieve sleep has a payback, where people often the next day feel very disoriented, very out of sorts, and very desperate once again to achieve sleep. And it's interesting, but what they don't know is their brain is desperate for them to achieve REM rather than sleep in and of itself. So the only medication that I've come across, and I know I've heard of one or two more, but the one that I have heard can be a bit of an effective gateway into sleep while at the same time allowing REM, is sort of not a drug by any means. I think it's more of a herb called melatonin.
Yeah.
And so I've heard many, many stories, and I've read a number of accounts where the use of melatonin can facilitate sleep. Mm. Also, just wanted to say something that I'd mentioned prior, but deserves repeating for this episode and topic, that when people are on SSRIs, Sertraline, Luvox, Effexor, that when you combine alcohol with these SSRIs, you have what's called a bit of a logarithmic effect, such that, you know, one drink on an SSRI can sort of equal one drink, but two drinks can equal three drinks in terms of the effect. Three drinks can equal six. And so you have this increasing exponential increase of effect of the medication plus the alcohol. Very few people are aware of this. And so if, once again, you combine alcohol with these SSRIs, you can often have a very, very powerful effect. And many people report that they actually can, you know, black out after four drinks, where without being on the SSRIs, they could certainly handle a lot more alcohol. But it is important to be reminded that combining alcohol with SSRIs, especially to achieve sleep, can have very negative consequences. So people are, I think, very, very desperate is the word that most often comes to mind to achieve sleep. And I think that in terms of this term called insomnia, insomnia is a condition where people's relationship with sleep is very disrupted and disruptive, such that people either have a very difficult time falling asleep, or some people fall asleep and then find that their brain wakes them up in the middle of the night, in the middle of their sleep, either once or a number of occasions. And then people have a difficult time getting back to sleep. And then the third disruption is what would be called early morning awakenings, or waking up before one's alarm goes off or before one's desired time. So there are some theories as to why one of these three circumstances might occur. The most common theory is that people who have difficulty getting to sleep are, not surprisingly, kind of suffering from anxiety, where they're anxious about their spike theme, they're anxious about being at some risk, but often they're anxious about not being able to control or achieve sleep. And many people find that they can be very tired in the evening. They might even be falling asleep watching TV, reading a book. And absolutely, they are ready to enter the wonderful world of dreamland. But the minute their head hits the pillow in bed, they wake up like an alarm has gone off, because now is showtime to achieve this desired and desperate state. And that desperation activates often a very anxious and sometimes an extreme panic in that moment, because now they're aware that they're going to try to achieve a goal that is completely unachievable. And that brings up the topic of a term that I've coined a while ago called independent systems. Things in our mind and our body that we have no control over, but generally the brain and body kind of regulate themselves. Sleep is certainly one of those independent systems, as is anxiety, as are intrusive thoughts. And you know, with sleep, if we try to control an independent system, it often backfires and produces a very likely paradoxical impact, meaning the more desperate you are to sleep, the less likely you are to achieve that goal. Many people report that the moment they fall asleep, their brain wakes them up, because sleep has become such a desperate goal and entity to achieve that the brain says, "Hey, you just fell asleep," and wakes them from that sleep. And so that can be a very, very demoralizing moment. So theory also has it, I'm not sure how totally well supported, that when people wake up early, that that's a form of depression. And so please, any listeners, don't think that if you wake up early, that means you're depressed. I don't want to spike anyone or have anyone achieve any desperation to find out whether they're depressed, because many of my patients actually have an OCD theme where they're actually afraid they're depressed. And so if people wake up early and they think, oh my God, this means I'm depressed, you know, that can definitely be a spike. So definitely don't use this podcast or any podcast to derive any diagnoses, and please never use this podcast as a substitute for therapy. So moving on, in CBT, there is something called sleep hygiene. And I am not a fan of the CBT utilization of sleep hygiene. I'm not saying it's not well-based, it's not well-researched. Clearly, there's a lot of people in the scientific community who are real big fans of sleep hygiene. So I will just mention briefly what the guidelines of CBT sleep hygiene involve. First and foremost, the guidelines suggest to only use your bed for sleep purposes and romantic purposes. They suggest that you go to bed at the same time, and they suggest that you wake up at the same time. They really are big fans of developing a routine for sleep and wake up. They strongly recommend that people don't try to compensate for their lack of sleep at night by taking naps during the day, because once again, they're really big on like kind of predictable routines and creating guidelines for the brain to say, oh, look, we're doing these things. That means sleep is certainly on the way. So minimal naps, minimal coffee, let's say in the afternoon or evening, or any type of caffeinated stimulants. And also they are big advocates of not using alcohol also before bed, because alcohol can easily turn to sugar, and sugar can act as a stimulant. So they also talk about a nighttime ritual before bed, not to be surprised. That might include brushing your teeth, you know, flossing, folding your clothes for the next day, you know, to really create a routine, once again, to signal to the brain that, you know, hey, we're heading to bed soon, and sleep is going to be the natural consequence. The reason that I'm not a big fan of CBT sleep hygiene is because it's almost like it places a magical sequence of events and a magical formula where sleep is the goal. And not surprising, the Philipson sleep hygiene absolutely does not make sleep the goal. The goal in bed is rest. We can control, you know, putting our body in a comfortable position, you know, putting our head on our pillow. And the goal of Philipson sleep hygiene is to achieve comfy cozy, the idea that you're just relaxed, you're feeling comfortable, and bed is a nice place to be. It's a nice place to achieve rest. Sleep is something that the brain turns on, usually in an environment that is conducive for sleep to visit us. And sleep is definitely a visiting type of entity. I almost look at sleep as like when I was a kid, I used to want Santa Claus. I used to want to be awake when Santa Claus came and put the presents under the tree. And, you know, my mom told me that Santa Claus won't come with the toys if you're awake around the tree. So, you know, you got to go to bed. And sleep is a lot like Santa Claus. If you stay awake waiting for Santa Claus or sleep to visit, you're going to be very frustrated and very, very disappointed. So Philipson sleep hygiene is really targeted at the absence of desperation. And in my mind, desperation is the key factor in avoiding or postponing sleep onset. Many people are desperate because they believe that we need sleep as human beings. And so once again, I'd like to offer a spike alert or intrusive thought alert, because there are actually people who think that without sleep, they could die. So somewhere on the internet, there are some information that suggests that we can actually perish from a buildup of non-sleep. Now, in my entire career of 35 years, I have never known a single person to die from sleep loss. And I think that we're more likely to die from being hit on the head by a comet than we are from sleep deprivation. But so, A, people think that we could die. And so, you know, they really are almost trying to save their life by getting to sleep, which, of course, is going to have a very nasty paradoxical effect. People also, you know, say silly things like, oh, you know, when people hear about me getting 5.5 hours, they say to me, oh, Steve, I need 8 hours or I need 10 hours. And I just kind of laugh and I'm just like, you don't need 8 or 10 hours. Your brain knows exactly how much sleep you are programmed for. And that's what's really important about, you know, allowing sleep to be not a human chosen agenda, but a brain chosen agenda. So if I do wake up early, and that still happens, you know, I just basically say, I'm now going to function through today. And whatever limitations I have, because I'm in some degree of sleep deprivations, I'm just going to kind of deal from the cookies from the cookie jar, the crumbs from the cookie jar, in terms of whatever minimal resources are available. That's what I'm going to kind of deal with and get by with, and not look for or resent an awareness that I am functioning at less than optimized Steve. And I think this is another huge contributor to this concept where desperation takes away from sleep, is this idea that for me to be optimized tomorrow, I need these 8 hours or 10 hours. So you know, people become very, very fragile and very resentful for the absence of sleep. And so going back to Phillips and sleep hygiene, resentment once again comes up as a very important factor to not substantiate. It's important that we not resent that we not get to sleep right away. And it's important that we not resent waking up in the middle of the night. And it's important that we not resent being woken up before our alarm goes off. So another little secret of sleep, Phillips and sleep hygiene, is the idea of never, never, never look at your clock. After your head has hit that pillow, put a covering over your clock, put your iPhone away. Do not monitor how long it's taking you to get to sleep. I think that's the worst thing you can do, because tracking, oh my God, I only have, you know, 8 hours until my alarm goes off. I've been in bed now for a half, so now I only have 7.5 hours. Oh my God, boy, am I screwed for tomorrow. So never look at your clock while you're being kept awake. Never look at your clock when the brain wakes up in the middle of the night. And never look at your clock, you know, if you wake up before your alarm goes off. Because if you wake up, you don't know whether it's, you know, 1 a.m. and you've only slept for 3 hours. You know, and in that regard, if you don't get back to sleep, oh my God, you're screwed. You don't know if it's 5 a.m, your alarm's about to go off in 2 hours. If you don't get right back to sleep, oh my God, you've got that sleep loss. So looking at the clock is always a lose-lose. Yeah. So that's something that I'm very adamant about. And the other thing that I think can be a sleep facilitator, and this is something that I do for myself, is if I do feel that I'm having a bit of a difficult time getting to sleep, I'll just put a little audio book in my ear with, you know, an earbud. And I'll just listen to someone read to me a book. Often it'll be a book I've already heard, so I don't have a excited desperation to make sure that I don't miss anything. And I'll put my audiobook on a snooze. So it'll go off maybe in 45 minutes or an hour. Often, you know, I'll go to sleep while it's being read to me, not really wake up, you know, when it turns itself off. So that's some of my, you know, little, shall I say, tricks of the trade. But once again, keep in mind, the goal is not sleep. The goal is restful nighttime inactivity.
Yeah, kind of like the goal is to make it even simpler, like to chill out, just lay in bed and chill out. Like that's the goal. I mean, chill out's pressure to a point, but yeah, just to enjoy being in bed, not to achieve anything, just to be. So the with a CBT sleep hygiene in the UK, I know they talk a lot about, and I do with my clients if sleep comes up, about blue light, about trying to reduce the amount of blue light before bed. Do they say that in the CBT guidelines, your side of
the ones that I was looking at don't mention it, but I'm not saying in any way that it's a positive or a detriment. I think that, you know, thinking about this presentation for quite a while, thinking, you know, during World War II, during Vietnam, soldiers are out on the front line. It's, you know, one in the morning, they're dead tired, and they can go to sleep knowing that the enemy is 100 yards away. Hopefully someone else who's sharing the foxhole with them is staying awake. But just to kind of say, you know, we don't need a perfect mattress. You know, we doesn't matter whether we've looked at blue light or not blue light. The brain is well aware of how much sleep that our mind and body will function optimally on. And if we sort of let it do its thing, it will give us sort of what we're looking for. And humans can survive on tremendous amounts of little sleep. There's a training to become a SEAL, which is a very highly trained special forces unit. And in the week that these SEALs are trained, I think, and 7 days, I think they allow them, I think it's about 14 hours of sleep total, which is 2 hours a night. Yeah. And so they really sort of torture these trainees, but it also really goes to show that we can survive and function pretty well on extremely little amounts of sleep.
Yeah. And they're, so, you know, so they're of course really exerting themselves as well. Cause that week, they call it hell week, because it's like hell.
That's right. Yeah. The next day they're not sipping tea and crumpets. they are carrying around very large weights or swimming in, you know,
shark
water
that
can fill you if you're in it for an hour.
Yeah.
So yeah, they are pushed to their limit, and it's sort of like a week where it's designed to get you to quit.
Yeah.
And so therefore only those who are most durable, you know, kind of move on to further training. I just want to say also that a lot of people, you know, when our head hits the pillow, the brain often says things like, hey, this is a great time to think about some of your days and daily problems. And so people with perfectionism often are kept up because they give in to that brain temptation. And they start really problem solving, you know, a lot of life's issues. And so it's not a surprise that when the brain says, you know, go through this door of trial and tribulation in your life and try to work on solving the difficulties of living, when a person gives into that, it really just reinforces the brain's tendency to see bed as a great opportunity. It's a chamber of problem solving. And so people complain that the brain brings up all of these life complexities. And I'm just like, well, you reinforce it by giving into that. It's like any other thought. the brain can, you know, introduce an intrusive thought or a worrisome thought. And it's up to us to not take the bait. It's up to us to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to delve into this topic. I'm going to shift to a theme that's a lot more conducive to my being able to get to sleep. And, you know, that's not to say doing it once is going to, quote unquote, do the trick. It's really important that you really engage in the ongoing discipline of, you know, not using that time to problem solve and try to solve, you know, all of the world's problems. I'm not sure if I mentioned in greater depth, but a lot of people actually have panic attacks while sleeping, because the topic is so fraught with this desperation. And it's really important that you not fight against the panic attack. You know, you deal with nighttime panic attacks by just allowing the storm to kind of come wash over you and not necessarily get out of bed, run around and seek some type of relief. That reminds me also, going back to the CBT sleep hygiene, and this is the one thing that I most disagree with. They say if you're in bed for about 20 minutes and haven't gotten to sleep, then kind of get up, read a book, you know, therefore you're only associating the bed with sleep. And I think that once again, that just produces more of an awareness of how much time has gone by and how sleep is, you know, not visiting. So therefore people see it as a failure. And it's really, really important that sleep not be given the designation as being success or failure. You know, it, once again, if you've laid in bed for, you know, a number of hours resting, then, you know, you've crossed the finish line, you've met the mark, and to not look at it as in sleep needs to come. Did you have any questions, Stu?
Yeah. So I think kind of on what you just said, and also you mentioned before in more detail around the clock watching, and if you wake up, don't check the time. And obviously for most people, it's probably the phone on their bedside table, or I just chuck it on the floor and I'll reach over and get it. And I've been getting up a lot recently because of my daughter, you know, to put her back to sleep and stuff. And especially if I'm like, hey, I've got clients tomorrow, and then I'm like, I need to be cognitively at my best in session and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm checking the phone, and then I'm like, oh, no, it's 3. Okay, now it's 4, now it's 5. And I'm like, I might be able to get 2 hours sleep, hopefully, if she goes down now. And then I'm so stressed that I can't sleep. So what I've started to do, is just not check my phone. And I have to almost tell myself, do not check that phone, because the urge is I want to check the phone and know what time it is to know how much sleep I'm going to get, because the number was important to me of, okay, I need to get at least 6, you know, hours. And now I'm like, what I get is what I get. Knowing the time makes no difference to my brain getting enough sleep. And that's helped a lot more in sort of me stay relaxed throughout the night.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. When I was in sort of my darkest time in my relationship with sleep, my brain actually kept me awake two and a half nights in a row. And so on Monday to Tuesday, I slept 0. Tuesday to Wednesday, I slept 0. And I just thought I was going to be a complete train wreck the next day without any sleep at all. And what's funny is I'm never as bad as my brain tells me I'm going to be. So, you know, back then I used to have a much more desperate relationship with sleep. You know, I used to get up, I used to go to a different bedroom, thinking, you know, that'll be a place more conducive to sleep, because I didn't want to disturb my wife by rolling around looking for the optimal spot. And, even with, the third night where I only got maybe 3 hours of sleep, you know, the next day, once again, I was functioning a lot better than I thought I would be. Actually, I thought I did pretty well that day. And from that point forward, my brain has never done that again. Because I really think I'm able to look at my brain saying to me, you're going to be a mess tomorrow, and being like, oh, yeah, well, I can do really well on eensy weensy amounts of sleep. So even with none, so it really took away the claws of desperation to see that I didn't need that much sleep in order to, you know, function at some desirable, certainly wasn't optimal, but it was sufficient. And so, you know, I'm sort of a big fan of the statement, you know, good is good enough. And that's kind of what I go by. And therefore, I'm no longer a hostage of anxiety's ability to kind of keep me awake. And I think that when people put these principles into effect, they too can kind of see that they didn't need that new bed. You know, they didn't need those new pillows. They didn't need to go to bed at exactly the same time. And what's also funny is that on a Friday night, I can go out to dinner. I can drink coffee after my deep meal. It's 10 p.m. Here I am, and I hate decaf, so I'm drinking caffeinated coffee. I'll have a drink or two, maybe, you know, a dessert. And my sleep from Friday to Saturday is never a problem because there's no pressure. I can be very sleep deprived on Saturday. I don't really give a damn. All I'm doing is hanging out and enjoying the day. There's no real mental faculty pressure. And so Saturday to Sunday, sort of the same thing. So it's just kind of funny that this is so predicated for the most part on, you know, this idea of needing to function, needing to be optimized the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What was I going to say? Yeah. It's good that I don't have like a lot of podcasts have mattress sponsors, you know, where they're like, and then you get a whatever 90-day try it. And if you don't like it, send it back. So it's a good job I don't have one of those because I probably would have lost them throughout this episode. I think, you know, a lot of what you said, around the kind of, well, what comes to my mind is the phrase sort of get out of your own way with around the sleep. And you've talked before around like OCD being like the scab. So, or the, you know, we pick the scab and we keep picking the scab and it doesn't heal. It keeps scabbing over and eventually it scars. When really, if you leave the scab alone, it will heal itself. The wound will heal itself. The scab will fall off and your arm in this case will be better. And you've talked before in other episodes about the brain being like a self-healing organism.
It's a machine, you know, it's a wonderful machine.
Okay, yeah. So it just reminds me exactly what you're implying here, that it's the same, just to a point, get out of our own way around sleep.
Yeah, and absolutely. There's so much misinformation about sleep which generates so much desperation. And, you know, I mean, how many times do you hear people say things like, oh, I need 8 hours, which is such a misnomer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get 3, sometimes I get 8. I just take what I'm given and just, I have faith that the machine knows best, that Steve is not going to be the regulator of how much sleep I need, because I don't really, you know, pay attention the next day, of my kind of optimized functioning. I live life where I just kind of make room for Steve's level of functioning. As I say, I exist between 70% of optimized Steve to 95%. I never look for, expect, demand that I would be at 100%. And if I'm between 70 and 95%, I'm very satisfied. Occasionally, I'll be aware that my brain isn't functioning even at 70%. And once again, what am I going to do? That's an independent system. I can't turn up some dial and be like, okay, thank God I'm back at 70. But once again, just make room for me at 70 or 60 or 50%. I'm just gonna, you know, kind of deal from whatever cards are available from the deck, no matter how many cards are missing. And, you know, I've never had a session where my patient has been like, Steve, you've only been at 50% today. I'm very, very aware of that degree of access to my brain's faculties. Very, very few other people are. Yeah. But once again, even if that were to be noticed, I would just give my brain permission to have that variability and give others permission to see that as a human being, I have variability, and sometimes that variability can dip to some pretty low numbers, and that's just, you know, unavoidably okay.
Yeah, good point. And on the whole brain, like, I'd say threatening, like almost threatening, saying if you don't get this much sleep, this dire thing's going to happen, as you said. In session for me, which is probably one of the most cognitive things I do, is be a therapist. And the worst it gets when I have been really sleep deprived, I might just forget what I was going to say. And then I own up to it. I've just forgotten what I was going to say. And then I'm sure it'll come back to me. And sure enough, most of the time it comes back to me and we continue talking. So like that's the worst. But my brain was telling me I wouldn't be able to function. I'm not going to be able to do my job, all of this stuff, which never came true.
Yeah. And all of those warnings promote the magic word in this presentation, which is desperation, really is the key deterrent to natural sleep visitation, as desperation for any independent system, will produce that paradoxical effect. So, I love the term, the phrase faith in default, you know, where I can go into a situation, whether sleep deprived, whether feeling anxious, and just have faith that my own natural skills can kind of unfold and that I'll just accept what's available. And that's certainly what I advocate for people with sleep or any form of performance, to just allow whatever's available to be. Yeah. And so for people to try to really adopt that principle, to be able to go to bed and say, hey, like Steve said, rest is the goal, whether sleep visits or not, that's not my department. Mm-hmm. And so whether I'm kept awake, not my department, woken up middle of the night, totally not my department, woken up before the alarm goes off, not my department. And so I really work on separating things that I can make choices about from things that I can't. I can choose to put an audiobook in if it seems like, let's say I've woken up early and I'm not going to be able to get back to sleep. I'll just put an audiobook in. And so the worst thing that's happened is for an hour or so, I'll listen to someone read a book to me. No big deal.
Do you ever listen to my podcast to put you to sleep?
I always tell people, if they want to go to sleep, just listen to the Choice article. Many of my patients say that knocks them right out when it's read to them. So I definitely advocate everyone, if you want to go to sleep, listen to the Choice article. It's a good sleepy time story.
Nice. Yeah. And obviously you let me publish that on the show as well. I can link to that for people. That's interesting. So let me look at my questions. I guess one of my questions was, and you've answered it, but I'll ask it more explicitly. So, you know, when someone wakes up in the night and they get hit with an OCD spike, obviously they're going to feel the urge to want to compulse and go in that whole cycle. Any words of wisdom around that?
Well, once again, permission giving is the first and foremost response that a person can make a choice about, to give their brain permission to have that spike, and to not look at it as a problem or something bad that's just occurred. So, try to redirect the focus onto chosen topics that are more conducive to sleep visiting, rather than, you know, ritualizing. Mm. But I'm glad you asked that question, because it reminded me of a topic that I just hadn't covered yet, which is dreams.
Yeah.
People, you know, often first and foremost will dream about their spike themes. Mm-hmm. So a person with HOCD might actually have a dream in which they're engaged in same-sex behavior. People with POCD might have a dream where they're engaged with, you know, sexual behavior with a child. You know, people might in their dreams be cursing God, or people might be, you know, falling into a sewer full of poop, you know. Mm-hmm. So keep in mind that the brain will generate dream topics that are very much related to the OCD spike, because it's doing nothing more than its own problem solving. The brain definitely sees themes within OCD as a crisis, as an emergency that the person needs to be extricated from. And so some of what dream content involves often is problem solving, trying to resolve, you know, a conflict. That's first and foremost. Sometimes dreams, and this is the most common theory that Freud propagated well over 100 years ago, is the idea that dreams represent wish fulfillment. So when people come up with that information and then they dream about some type of spike theme, that can really, really be disruptive. Many, many people wake up from dreams within their OCD content and become very distressed, you know, that they had that dream, and will start ritualizing right off the bat because, oh my God, what does this mean? It's the same thing with nightmares. These are independent systems. Rarely ever do they really offer us anything substantive. It's usually just a topic that the brain sees as being unresolved and that the brain is trying to resolve on its own, you know, kind of time, because dream content is definitely brain chosen material. And once again, we can't control it. If I could choose my dream content, I'd be sleeping for 20 hours, I assure you. I'd be dreaming about some great things too. And one of them might be, you know, you and I on the yacht, sharing a sail.
Yeah. It's funny. I think with nightmares, it's like we call it nightmares, but really they're dreams. They're just dreams we don't want. So we label them as nightmares. But it's interesting. Obviously, the more I'm sure we've all had that experience where we're talking to someone just before we go to bed about something, and then we dream about it. Because it's like, and obviously, if you're obsessing all day, your brain's going to go, hey, this is important to you because you keep thinking about it. Here it is in your dreams too. Keep working on it.
That's right.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So
I just want to mention for those who may not be informed, people who are on SSRIs, one of the common side effects is what's called vivid dreams. So whereas most of us, when we wake up, we're like, oh, I had dream about X. When people on SSRIs wake up, it's almost indistinguishable from did it really happen. So just really important to be kind of brought up to speed that dream content and impact and sort of clarity are influenced by SSRIs. So one last topic, also in terms of nighttime behavior, and that is what's called a breakthrough dream. Once again, I want to give a spike alert. If you want to skip the next 5 minutes, definitely do that, because this is going to create some challenges for some people. Mm. A breakthrough dream is where someone might scream out loud during a dream, or flail their arms about, or even some people rarely, but occasionally engage in sleepwalking. So I've had a few patients with sleepwalking who spike that they might harm someone while sleepwalking. And once again, I've never heard of any instance of anyone committing any type of violent behavior. But for some people who engage in what are called these breakthrough dream events, this is associated not always, but often with trauma. And so it is sort of important to keep in mind that if you are a victim of some type of trauma, that it can manifest itself in these kind of breakthrough dreams. So if your partner says, hey, you were screaming last night, or your arms were bouncing around, you know, there may be something very upsetting going on in your life. You may feel very, very threatened by something, or you may have had some early trauma. Now, I'm definitely not saying this is a, you know, one-to-one proportion. It's something to look into. It's definitely not something to make a conclusion about. So, you know, once again, this is just information for people's ability to do further research. Please do not think if you have breakthrough dreams that you've been a victim of trauma, or that there's definitely something going on in your life that is critically important.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'll sometimes shout out in my dream, apparently. and I know I have a friend who does that. He'll sit up and like mumble loads of stuff. It's interesting. I mean, probably not for the person next to them, but it's interesting that it happens. So one more question from me that you haven't answered yet, which is, and I think this doesn't just apply to sleep, it could apply to any kind of self-care thing. And I say sleep as a self-care thing, it's just something our brain has to do at some point, taking the pressure off, which is around guilt. So especially with, like, you know, really taboo, intrusive thoughts, some people get to the point where, you know, with eating or sleep, like, I don't deserve to sleep, or I don't deserve to get good sleep or sleep well, or I don't deserve to be laying here and enjoying my bed right now. How do you work with that kind of guilt and shame, maybe about who they are as a result of just having lived with these thoughts for so long?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't ever think of the world in terms of deserving or not deserving. I think as human beings, we deserve sleep and any other pleasure. Guilt, Stu, is a universally irrational emotion. Guilt, shame are irrational emotions that are often predicated on irrational beliefs about this idea of oneself, which is also an irrational perspective. Mm-hmm. The idea of relating to you or one's being as a self. And that's a very complicated topic. I think we might have actually discussed it before. And I think you and I might have disagreed on that one. But, you know, the idea of I don't deserve to sleep or have any rewarding aspect of life is definitely an irrational concept. But it's interesting. You know, people will often have guilt about their dream content. And I think that's really important to understand, once again, that our dream content is not of our choice, nor is it like any spike indicative of anything relative about us as a person.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Yeah, very good point. And again, it's out of our control, dreams. So it's not something we chose to do. Okay, I guess, and then you've answered everything. So lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared, or anything you want to say to kind of wrap this topic of sleep up?
I mean, just to repeat, I can't say enough that if desperation is something that we choose, although many people, when they go to bed, as I mentioned before, it becomes a trigger for the horrendous panics, the horrendous, tug of war of not being in control of something. And so to really, you know, trust your brain machine. It's an amazing device. It really is designed for our optimization, although people with OCD would rarely say that. But it definitely is intended to keep us as humans sustained on what's called homeostasis. Homeostasis is a state of just pleasant levelness, you know, not hungry, not tired. It's just our natural functioning. And so trust that the brain is always looking for that, and that we don't have to impose our own control to achieve homeostasis.
Yeah, really good way to end. Thank you for coming on and talking about this topic. Hopefully, I'm sure it will help many people and hopefully get some good night's sleep, if that's not probably not the right way to say it. But
well, what I would prefer we say is we hope they really enjoy their rest this evening.
Nice.
Yeah. And if the little sleep Santa Claus comes and visits, great. If it doesn't, that's not really a big deal.
Yeah, and I guess something that came to my mind earlier, it's similar to happiness, right? If we chase happiness, we don't get it. Happiness is a byproduct of living our life and doing things and meaning and stuff like that. And then happiness bites us on the ass and, you know, and then we're happy for a bit. But yeah, if we really look for happiness, we just can't attain it a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think the word that I think that's very, very important to this happiness or even finding a romantic partner is the word attachment. It's an Eastern concept, if you've run across it in your own sort of Eastern studies. And certainly sleep is distanced by having an attachment. An attachment's the idea that we become desperate to achieve a certain goal. And when we let go of our attachments, things tend to come to us that are sort of naturally intended for our functioning. And so attachment is very akin to desperation. It just has more of a kind of an Eastern perspective to it.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, I'm glad you added that. Well, let's end it there. Thank you again.
You're welcome. Great seeing you again.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thanks again to Cambridge University Press and Dr. Lynn Drummond's new book for supporting the show. Lynn's book, Everything You Need to Know About OCD, is now available. To get 20% off, go to cambridge.org/everythingOCD and use discount code OCDstories20 at the checkout. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.